I'm Christopher Lydon with David Bromwich, the Sterling Professor of English at Yale. The question is war with Syria. David, I keep coming back and back to your quiet study because I'm learning that it takes a literary man like you to decipher language, plot, character, context, deeds, deception, especially in this tornado of arguments, none of which seem terribly clarifying around Syria. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude. We're in New Haven on the weekend before Congress takes up President Obama's war plan, just after the world leaders of Petersburg, the G20, plus the UN Secretary General, plus the Pope, almost everybody but the President of France have turned thumbs down on the idea of a U.S. attack on Syria. David Bromwich, tell us the signal you hear in all the noise.
Well, we now know, and I don't see this changing in the coming week, that he does not have popular support. The polls are going against war, something like 3-2 of the people who know anything about it and want to have an opinion, in the 40% against war and in the 20% in favor of it. And it looks as if Congress, as of now, the weekend before the vote is likely to take place, Congress are so troubled by the consistency of the skepticism they're hearing from their constituents and in masses that they may well vote against it. If they vote for it, I can only imagine the intervention of one of two things or both changing the story. One is an incident, a new incident, whether real or manufactured, we probably won't know immediately. And the other is the force of the Israel lobby. We don't know what kind of campaign they can mount or what will happen behind closed doors. It's possible those factors will come in. But right now, it looks as if, very possibly, Congress will vote against, not the Senate, but Congress will vote against the authorization for the use of force. And if so, Obama has an interesting choice because he can, at that point, back away and say, I thought this was necessary, but I'm a leader of a democratic country, and I can't do something that people so thoroughly disagree with, especially where it involves violence, the threat of war, and eventually the threat of the sacrifice of American soldiers in war. On the other hand, you know, he is very hard to figure out at this moment because he had a good chance to make just such a, you know, move of backing off, a strategic retreat, by the very fact that we know General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is not keen on reprisal, or what we're calling punishment of Syria. He doesn't want to begin any military action right now, and for whatever reason, he does not see the urgency of answering the apparent crossing of a red line by Assad, if Assad is the one who used chemical weapons near Damascus. Dempsey is against this. He's being a loyal soldier and testifying to the committees for the president, but we know that Dempsey and perhaps Hagel are very skeptical. Obama could simply have said, I go with the best military advice I get, and that's my chairman of the Joint Chiefs. But he did not. He went instead with the Democratic and Republican, neoconservative and neoliberal, militarized empire establishment that have wanted a war against Syria all along, have wanted to overthrow Assad on the way to attacking Iran, however that can or must be done. So it's very hard to figure what his calculations are all around. There's another element in the White House mix, if you will, of advisors on this, and that is the humanitarian war group centered on Samantha Power and Susan Rice. Susan Rice likes to talk, but hasn't been heard from at all on this issue, and I think it's because she's felt not to lend much credibility to any cause after her testimony on Benghazi. But she is the national security advisor, and she's been tweeting her own opinions in favor of war. This is new, too, to have a diplomat, somebody who would have been Obama's choice for Secretary of State, airing in public views that she is fighting for within the administration. And it was strange also for John Kerry, the chief diplomat of the United States, to be using a phrase like moral obscenity to describe an action which no international body had yet assigned blame for. So there's something unhinged about the quality of the different voices we're hearing around the White House. And I think the least you can say against President Obama right now is that he does not seem in control.
That's heavy. What do you mean? And if he's not, who is or what is?
There are large forces that he feels working on him, forces that are so substantial that even the popular clamor of large numbers of Americans against a new war, just what you think this president might have favored, doesn't count for as much as you might expect it to. Some of the forces have to do with the militarized policy of the United States in that region, in the Middle East, for the last 10 years, something that President Obama has tried to work with and not extend too much, but with secret wars, as with secret surveillance in the United States, we've been discovering that things have been allowed to go farther along the path set out by Bush and Cheney, only it's been done more silently, and there's been some drawing it in under the shade, the shadow, the umbrella of the law. Perhaps some more consultation, but it's hard to say with a matter like Libya or our efforts of sabotage in Iran or the firing of drone missiles in Yemen, exactly what the state of public knowledge is about these covert or half-public, half-concealed operations. Obama's part of that machine now. He gives every sign of not liking the machine, but as it jerked forward with the French reports of chemical attacks in Syria, he gave the sort of hints he shouldn't have given if he wanted to resist thoroughly, and said, well, there might be circumstances in which I would have to go to war in Syria, and so he opened the door. He said things which a more tutored, a more tactful, a more careful president wouldn't have said, but he likes to talk. He likes to pronounce, and he got into trouble with his remark about red lines.
I find everybody sort of re-gauging their sense of who Barack Obama is, and I'm dying to hear your view. I just throw out a notion that as I watched him talking about Martin Luther King on the 50th anniversary of the Great March, I felt he was uncomfortable. He knew he was squelching himself somehow on the peace advocate in Martin Luther King, the whole wariness on King's part that we were the great purveyor of violence in the world during the Vietnam War. Obama was editing all that out, but he knew it, and he seemed self-conscious about it and uncomfortable. 2 days later, he announced, we're going to the Congress. I am the leader of the oldest constitutional democracy in which the people, through their representatives, declare war, not me, not the royal prerogative. What did that tell you? I thought on the second go, he seemed so much more centered, healthy, happy, speaking his own mind. But I'm as puzzled as anybody else.
If Congress says no to the war and Obama says, I can't go against the suffrage of the people of the United States and their representatives in Congress assembled, then you will be proved right. Then the change of motive and the feeling more with himself because he went to the machine of democracy instead of that other machine, I think that will be borne out. I hope you're right. I hope that's true.
It was a very strange juxtaposition. Praising Martin Luther King on Wednesday, going to war on Thursday, as we first expected. I mean, I keep wondering, where is the Nobel Prize president? Where is the successful candidate who said, I won't do dumb wars, very clearly out of the pack on Iraq. Where's the mind of the man on this weekend when he says, I'm not itching for war, and yet he's trying like crazy to sell it?
Well, he was on the dissident left liberal side on Iraq when he was a state senator. You know, you look at his Cairo speech in early 2009. He did seem to bode a sort of internationalism that was very different from anything we'd seen in previous years. I don't have a clever answer about why the hopes from that speech and other such manifestations of early President Obama were disappointed. I think the obvious answer must have something to it, that he's not as strong as he took himself to be, and that the forces against him are far stronger than he took them to be. I think one has to add to that that a man like Obama, who is not the most single-minded, not the most consistent, not the hardest working, hardest driving, hardest thinking of presidents, more than other people needs very good and single-minded advisors around him. He has not had that. He bought the idea of team of rivals as the recipe for having a good candidate. And though that might have been a good idea for so strong-minded a thinker as Lincoln and so active a president as Lincoln, it was a very bad idea for a president like Obama. Nor did he have rivals of very great weight or authority. He's had a mediocre cabinet in his first term, and for the most part again in his second. So those are all factors in what we're seeing, I believe. And the people who most nearly advise him on foreign policy, Dennis McDonough and Benjamin Rhodes, are young, Rhodes in particular, and not seasoned in fighting the inside or outside fights. So it's very likely that Obama sees a reflection of his own ambivalences in the advice he gets from such people. It's amazing to me, but this comes from a reliable newspaper source, that in making his final decision to reverse himself on the intention to go to war and go to Congress after all, he did not even have in the room with him the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. They were out. Now that's remarkable. It doesn't contribute to the sort of coherence that he needs and can't generate from within.
Come back to some of these threads. The international outreach in Cairo, the Kenyan blood in the man himself, his cosmopolitan spirit. What does that, the rejection of the G20 leaders, the European Union almost unanimously, to this exercise in Syria, how does that register on Barack Obama, do you think?
It must be discouraging. This is a man who needs encouragement a lot, and who, in what has been relatively a charmed life and not too difficult a life between the ages of 28 and 45 or so, got encouragement in great heaps and got it without too much exertion on his part. And then he inherits, and this came out in Nobel Prize speech, which was a speech vindicating the whole history of American foreign policy since 1945, that the United States is a power for the good, and it is in itself a virtual bearer of the spirit of internationalism. And I think you're seeing carried out something of the promise of that speech, which I don't admire and don't agree with. That speech of December 2009, I believe it was, in what he's trying to do in Syria now, and in his peculiar trust that the world will agree to suppose that the United States punishing a bad man for imputed crimes against humanity, that the United States will be accepted as the equivalent of the United Nations. It's a very strange supposition, but I think Obama has come to believe it could happen. He's been disappointed by the world because the world turns out to think different.
The unilateral moralism in this whole conversation is the part that maybe gets under my skin the most, and in the voice of John Kerry, maybe most of all, because he's been so compromised in his own votes in the past, but others. What's to make of this persistent notion that we are the moral teacher and we'll enforce it with thunderbolts when we damn well please?
Well, the wisest words against that moralism, which can underlie imperialism, were spoken by John Quincy Adams as Secretary of State in 1821, when he said that America goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. And he meant that there really were monsters, but that it wasn't our business to destroy them. Quincy Adams went on to say that if we fell into a pattern of acting like that, like the nations of the old world building their empires, we might end up ruling the world, but America would cease to be the mistress of her own spirit. Now that's a powerful warning, and it can lodge in your mind if you read it or hear it even once. many people, and myself among them, had thought that Obama heard that warning and that it really sank in. But in America, and especially when you're in a position of power in America, I think the voices indicating omnipotence are so much more recurrent, powerful, finally overwhelming, that you start to believe then, and if you're very confident that you are a man of goodwill, you think that any action that emanates from you can't miscarry horribly and can't be part of the record of the arrogance of imperial power. It's just possible, I think, that President Obama believes Libya was a success. He may think that Libya, now overrun by warlords and Islamist militias, is a success. Certainly his appointment of Susan Rice, who had a key part in prompting his action in Libya, his appointment of her as national security advisor, might make us think that there was, for him, no rethinking in order after what occurred in Libya. So I don't know. I think there's a tendency of men of power, especially great power in the United States, to become so isolated that their thinking grows fantastic. I just mean dominated by fantasy. And, you know, we like to think an obviously intelligent and fairly balanced person, as Obama seemed to be, would escape that curse. But I don't think so. And I think a few counterexamples. I think of Jimmy Carter, who has become wiser about the world in his after years than he was as president. But even as president, he wasn't the worst. And I think of John Kennedy in the last year of his presidency, where so much more wisdom and sort of rueful knowledge of the limits of power and the limits that ought to be placed on power by itself seemed to inhabit the man. Obama's progression has not been like theirs. It's been from an outside, ironic, and interestingly non-attached point of view to something much more oriented to the conventional routes of American power.
David, you read everything, including everything online, but I'm wondering especially how you read the New York Times these days. It seemed to me the paper was shocked that President Obama went to Congress a week ago. I was also struck by that dramatic story yesterday about the rebels killing, in cold blood their prisoners. Very broadly, I mean, what can you tell about the country, including the established power, reading the New York Times?
Well, the Times, with two persons, Mark Landler and Michael Gordon, spearheading their coverage, has been riding Obama hard to intervene militarily in Syria. And that coverage goes back more than 6 months, more than a year. It came to a head in some articles in March and April, which I wrote about a little bit in the New York Review of Books, criticizing the Times for the partiality of its coverage. That's when Bill Keller wrote his editorial saying, we have to get over Iraq so we can get into Syria. But the Times doesn't want to be caught preaching from false facts to drag the U.S. into a war, as it did in Iraq. And so, you know, you find some interesting contradictory evidence offered there as well. A story in yesterday's paper, Thursday's paper, by C.J. Chivers, on the rebel killing of prisoners of war of the Syrian armed forces, you know, that could put a damper on your desire to subsidize whole, you know, groups of people whom you don't really know the nature of, and you don't know how to keep money out of their hands once you start channeling the money towards them. And there have been other stories, I think, that have a fair objectivity in the Times and that show an improvement since the disgraceful record they made on Iraq. But on the whole, there has been a division that's been discernible over months between a cautious, not very bellicose, regretful mood of hoping for peace and not wanting us to rush into anything on the unsigned editorial page, and pretty slanted pro-war coverage in the stories. As I say, if you see the name Gordon, who was involved in the purveying of the forgery material with Judy Miller, if you see the name Landler, you're seeing that kind of writing most of the time, not all the time. So I mean, the Times is a mixture of things. I gather, and I don't read it so regularly, that the Washington Post is far worse. But even there, some genuine reporting goes on. And, you know, a president who wanted to find it has plenty of material to fortify his skepticism and resistance to the war party at this moment. But again, the evidence is that this president hasn't been very resourceful collecting such materials.
The other big thing I keep wondering is, why isn't the Obama government exploring this new regime in Iran, the dreadful record of unending war in the Middle East, not to mention the sort of collapse of the Arab Spring, but why isn't there some seizing of this moment to stand back and find new allies, new interlocutors, new possibilities? It could be a very rich moment.
President Obama had a good chance to conclude adequate negotiations with Iran on the swap of partially enriched uranium when the offer from Brazil and Turkey came through in spring 2010. Trita Parsi has written about this in his book, A Single Roll of the Dice. And that plan was rejected by the Obama administration, almost sight unseen. It apparently was rejected because they wished they'd come up with it themselves, and they didn't want to give such prestige to minor powers like Brazil and Turkey. So there was a chance, and was a chance distinctly passed by. I agree, this is a moment, if any is, for looking out toward diplomacy with Iran, but I don't see how that combines with any of the language and any of the measures that the president has now supported. And going by today's news, and it's very dangerous to go by, I try not to be making philosophic hay out of current events, but, you know, Russia has now determined to move ships into the proximity of Syria, and Iran has said that there will be retaliation for any attack on Syria. And it looks to me as if Russia has decided that they will not let Syria go down easily, that they would be glad, perhaps, to make this our second Afghanistan. And Iran has decided to regard the move toward regime change, because that's what it is, if you believe Obama's assurances to McCain and Lindsey Graham. They've decided to regard the move towards regime change in Syria as step one of a two-step policy, which ends with destroying Iran as a major regional power. And it's surprisingly hard to, you know, refute either of these calculations, the Russian one or the Iranian one. So, you know, if peace, if diplomacy were the goal, even should Obama choose to go along with the democratic mood of the country and with a vote against him, suppose it happens in Congress, he has a long way to go in making his first big steps in diplomacy with Iran. I don't profess to know anything about that again, and it may be that a great deal is going on behind the scenes, but that's almost unimaginable given the temper of events.
There are so many other things that we might be doing, including, you know, clearing the record, having a wide open UN discussion on chemical weapons in general.
Yeah, I think that the discountenancing of the United Nations, maybe that's not the word, but the rejection of the UN as a sort of inferior body that we have to deal with. One thinks of this as a right-wing Republican attitude, not the view of a left liberal Democrat like Obama, if that's what he is. But this came out very markedly in John Kerry's contemptuous remarks about the UN, that the UN can't tell us anything we don't already know about weapons, and the UN has no mandate to tell us who did this, as if he didn't want to find out anything the UN could tell him, as if he'd already done all the homework himself, which obviously he hadn't, to judge by his statement on the chemical weapons. So, you know, this disregard toward the UN, I find a mysterious and a very bad sign. In general, I think Obama likes to speak in an international mood, but he hasn't been a caller of conferences, and he hasn't been a first-hand negotiator either. Not in Iran, not in Afghanistan, not with Russia, not with China with any success, not on global warming or anything else. Participation in the long haul of negotiations that can lead to a conclusion that that incorporates some compromises and so on. Just the very thing he talks about as the necessary element of leadership, he has not exemplified himself, and it's starting to seem as if it's alien to his personality.
You know, it's a coincidence of the calendar, but I find it so fascinating that John F. Kennedy, according to Ted Sorensen, was very mindful that he was living his presidency 100 years, day by day, after Abraham Lincoln. President Obama is living through now the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. The contrast is just sort of tempting, but I'm struck reading a lot about Kennedy's last year that the problems of the world forced themselves upon him and made him a kind of more serious man in those last months after the missile crisis to his death than he'd ever been. I'm wondering how the world's troubles invade Obama's space, his thinking, sort of force him to be on not just his best game, but to realize anew how momentous this job is that he wanted and won. Do you see that? Do you see a difference between the way the world enters the scope of JFK and now BHO?
I think that Obama, to start with, made out plans for his administration to emerge mostly as a domestic president. That is how Democrats like to be. Republicans love foreign policy.
I got to challenge you a little bit. My favorite Obama moment was in the campaign year before the conventions. He was speaking in Berlin and he said, "I greet you as a proud citizen of the United States and a fellow citizen of the world." It seemed to me the Kenyan Kansan consciousness had to project him into the world, even in all his fantasies.
In all his fantasies. But the practicalities and the contacts he had with people who were expert at the implementation of policy were all concerned, I think, with domestic policy. So, I mean, I think this partly accounts for the going in the tracks of the previous administration on foreign policy much and on security policy, much more than any of us could have anticipated. Mm. And the new work being mostly a matter of healthcare legislation, immigration reform, if he can push that through, and you know, gay rights and one or two other such reforms, and you know, those will be not unremarkable.
What is the difference, though, between the way the world forced itself in on President Kennedy, produced the nuclear test ban treaty, the conversation with Khrushchev, the might-have-been conversation with Castro, a deep reckoning around Vietnam, in ways that the world's crises don't seem to force themselves in on Obama and his circle?
That's a very sharp observation. I think Kennedy had an outgoing temperament and almost an appetite for action, for activity not just on the public stage, but with public consequences. Not all of this was good by any means, but he had learned a lot, become a wiser and a lonelier figure by 1963, partly because he saw what he was up against in the military. I like the story of, you know, John Frankenheimer, the director of Manchurian Candidate, requesting from Kennedy to borrow a couple of rooms in the White House for the making of 7 Days in May, a good thriller about a military conspiracy to take over the government of the United States. And Kennedy let them have it, went away for a couple of days and said to Frankenheimer, "These people," meaning the military, "are crazy. The American people need to understand that." Why is that unimaginable coming from Obama? It's that there isn't that feeling of firsthand engagement, of wanting to wrestle with problems. And it is an unusual human characteristic. And as Kennedy's example again shows, it carries with it some risky materials as well. But I think Obama is prudent and holds back and takes the messages that are borne in on him. I would think the Kennedy sort of personality coming into power in 2009, 2010, 2011 would have seen Iran as a possibly soluble and as the major problem for the United States, because it impinges so much on dealings with Russia and China as well, and on the Middle East. And Iran had allied itself with the U.S. in the war in Afghanistan, and then found itself utterly rebuffed by Cheney and Bush after the help they gave in 2001-2002, put into the outer darkness, called part of the axis of evil. Obama seemed to intend to change all that, but now, with the election of the new president, would have been the moment. Now would have been the moment to recognize, as Kennedy did about the test ban, now I can get some action. It's going to be hard, but I'll do it. We should not have more atmospheric nuclear tests. And now would be the moment to seek some sort of arrangement with Iran whereby they will never go to nuclear weapons, but they will be satisfied with their ability to use nuclear power domestically. This would have required enormous risk and real courage, as it did for Kennedy to go after the test ban and push it through. Let's never underestimate it. It's one of the most remarkable presidential achievements of my lifetime. And it would take courage for Obama to do that, courage to go against Israel. But he would have to have initiative, too, and he would have to be pursuing it himself. And appetite doesn't seem to be there.
What is to make of the virtual silence of Israel and the lobby and Bibi Netanyahu in this whole Syria question?
Well, the silence has just become a little less silent, to paraphrase Robert Frost's poem Desert Places. This emptiness will grow more empty ere it grows less, or words to that effect. In a Times story today by Judy Rudoran, who is, I think, a better reporter than the Times has had in Israel for some time, you get a quotation from Alon Pinkas, a former Israeli consul general in New York. And the statement goes, it's part of a story that says Israel now says it backs limited attack on Syria. Well, of course, by limited, they mean what Obama called limited and tailored, and that it should go on until it deters, degrades, and pretty well puts paid to the Assad forces. The Israeli former diplomat says this is a playoff situation in which you need both teams to lose, but at least you don't want one to win. We'll settle for a tie. Now, by both teams, he means the jihadist rebels in Syria, whom there is every reason for Israel and the rest of us to fear, and the Assad government. He wants both to lose, and Israel will take a tie. And the statement continues and concludes, let them both bleed, hemorrhage to death. That's the strategic thinking here. As long as this, meaning the civil war, the bloody civil war producing millions of refugees, as long as this lingers, there's no real threat from Syria. So there you have an Israeli admitting that the state of things that is constituted by the civil war is highly satisfactory to Israel from a strategic point of view.
How can this be? They're on the border of Syria. They're prime target for any sort of big or little retaliation. They're trying out gas masks again, but they had said almost nothing about the possibilities here, either of stopping the war or plunging ahead or worrying about what comes later.
I agree, and there are dissident Israelis, and I sympathize with them enormously, who also agree and who think that in the long run, Israel can't live in a state of perpetually creating new enemies by creating more or contributing to make more chaos around it. But in the short run, for a warlike state acting on Machiavellian principles, you know, Israel can stand to inherit the reputation of the only solid, the only reliable, the only non-chaotic country in the region, with the exception of the autocracies or the oligarchies such as Qatar and Saudi Arabia. If Israel emerges alone as the sole country in the entire Middle East that is not a devastation and that is solid looking and modern and Western in ways we Americans identify with, then Israel and the United States can march forward hand in hand towards whatever future. I think that's the, what to say, short and middle term so-called strategic thinking that's guiding this. I think it's very wrong. I want Israel to survive, and I don't think it will survive well or happily on these terms. But that's the Israeli calculation under Netanyahu now. I think that this former diplomat of Israel, and Judy Radoran pretty well indicates that in her article, is speaking the mind of the Israeli government. So they do back limited attacks in Syria, and you can bet the behind-the-scenes pressure from the Israeli government is much stronger than we're hearing leaked out to the Times. And we're gonna have a siege of it, I'm pretty sure, next week in, who knows, ads, but certainly visits to congressmen by lobbyists. So that, you know, that is a formidable pressure, and it had to be resisted earlier, and it had to be resisted effectively with statements that bore no ambiguous interpretation. That's another part of the corner that Obama's got himself into.
So when that irresistible force meets the immovable object of 2-to-1, 3-to-1 opposition to the war at the grassroots, what happens in the U.S. House?
It's, for anyone who perceives what's happening, it is one of the most astonishing confrontations between influence and democratic sentiment that there has ever been. And, you know, there never has been anything like the relationship between Israel now and the United States. And, you know, in foreign policy, the Israel lobby is the most formidable power, just as in domestic policy, the gun lobby is. It's legal, it's so on. But we've never seen this. We've never seen an anti-war public opinion that seems to me very unlikely to change a lot within the next few days.
David Brumwich, look on the bright side. It's a sort of slow-burning debate, but we are having a national conversation around war and war powers and presidential authority and intervention. It's a kind of blessing in some way. Isn't there something to rejoice in here?
Yes, the energy of the discussion, which has invigorated even me and caused me to write email letters to my congressman and two senators, and then to call the congressman again about this vote, has been something unusual. And I think it is a good democratic moment, and not just on the issues you mentioned, which are quite a few, but also on the national security state and on surveillance with all the releases of information that the public ought to have been informed of, that come now through more so-called legitimate and respected outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post, as well as from The Guardian, a wonderful paper on all this, and we owe everything to its coverage. But the Times story today, on Friday, what is it, September 6th, about the NSA control over encryption, to the extent that no American can trust that any of his passwords has not been cracked by the NSA, and that they intend to crack them all if they can. I mean, that's important for us to know, and it's important for us not to resent the challenge that we now adopt an opinion about it, because we should realize that as people who are supposed to be practicing self-government, we ought to have had an opinion about that all along. And I think a lot of the opposition or hostility or skepticism or sarcasm about the Snowden revelations, some of it, I'm sorry to say, coming from the Obama administration, relates to a kind of chagrin, a feeling of embarrassment that we are now forced to take a stance on something we could have just let go because it's been brought to our attention. We wish it hadn't. But this was a real continuous offense against democracy being committed by the bureaucratic machine of government, and that's part of the discussion going on too. And, you know, the whole Syria business has been an interruption of the NSA controversy. I don't think it can have been out of the mind of the White House that it served them well for a little while as a distraction. It replaced all those headlines. But I think the security discussion is going to continue as well. So it could be a great democratic moment if some liberals, the liberals whose liberality really is libertarian, and the right-wing libertarians who tend to be too closely concerned with property and guns, if they can get together in upholding, you know, obedience to the laws and the Constitution, it would be an interesting moment. It's not going to be led by any one person I see, but I have enormous admiration and take encouragement from people like my Senator Chris Murphy in Connecticut, who had the courage in his first term, in his first year, to vote against the authorization of force in Syria, part of that 10-7 vote. And Mark Udall has been strong on these issues as well as the NSA, and so has Ron Wyden of Oregon. So, I mean, these may be the people of the future, much more than the big names we've been hearing, names like McCain, Graham, Obama, etc.
Did you say Hillary Clinton?
I think she's one of the old names.
Speaking of old names, David, you know the scriptural writers on politics in the English language, especially going back to Burke by way of Lincoln and the great American founders. What would your man Burke or your other literary heroes on politics be observing, saying, advising?
I can give you just favorite quotations, one each, let's say, from Burke and from Lincoln, and they pertain to our situation now in ways that would be pretty obvious from Burke, from his letter to the sheriffs of Bristol. Power, in whatever hands, is rarely guilty of too strict limitations on itself. And from Lincoln, you know, a little piece of his... Is this fragment on government, or it's one of those other notebook fragments where he said, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. Well, I think we have to understand that power is dangerous in whatever hands. And that's why the separation of powers within government is important. It's why not just talking about accountability, but practicing it is so important. And one must renounce the wish for mastery. It's easy to think that you hate slavery, and easy to imagine the glory of rescuing other people from slavery, but are you not wanting to be master of something else? Are you not wanting to be master of justice in the world and the executor of justice in the world? One country isn't good enough to do that, because power in whatever hands is always guilty of wanting to go beyond limits.
David Brumwich, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure, like none other I know in this game.
Same here.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with David Brumwich, who is the Sterling Professor of English at Yale. His work in progress is a reconsideration of the 18th century oracle and conservative conscience of the British Empire, Edmund Burke. The conversation isn't over until listeners, that's you, leave a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.